Hello, I'm Charlotte Armitage and this is Objects.
On this episode, I'm speaking to Caroline Richardson. Caroline grew up in Glasgow. One of her earliest memories is when she and her sister were taken into care when Caroline was 3 years old. She went to live in a children's home with 40 other children. But despite being surrounded by other children, Caroline often felt alone and spent most of her time with her imaginary friend Jane, so that she felt connected to someone. This stemmed from the racism and prejudice she experienced growing up as a mixed race person in the 70s and 80s, particularly from staff members and other children of the home. When Caroline left care, she worked hard to conceal that she was care experienced. This all changed when she started working at a community centre and she found herself relating to care experienced young people she worked with. Since then, Caroline has been an unwavering children's rights defender. She started working for Who Cares Scotland shortly after as an advocate, and she's never looked back since. Caroline is now the longest standing worker at Who Cares Scotland and is every bit as committed to it as she was 20 years ago. I feel very lucky to know Caroline as another care experienced woman, and I know that many other care experienced people who have met Caroline feel the same way. Caroline, thank you so much for joining me on Objects.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
I'm sure many people from Who Cares Scotland will know who you are already, but for the listeners who don't know you, are you able to tell me a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So I was in care when I was younger, left care at the age of 17. I now work for Who Cares Scotland. I'm an advocacy and participation manager with Who Cares Scotland for the Lanarkshire region, and I have been with Who Cares Scotland for just over 20 years now, and still haven't got rid of me, so it's been the longest and most rewarding job, I think, of my life. So, and I'm married, I've got two children, and it's just that's me, that's just about it.
That's it. So before we go on to hearing all about your three chosen objects, I first want to just ask you how it was for you finding them. What was the process? How quickly did they come to you?
A couple of them came to me probably pretty quickly, I have to say. The one of the objects, I think it took me quite a long time to kind of almost find it. In the sense that I was just trying to find out what were the most important things of my childhood and my sort of care journey when I was younger, and I kind of grappled with that because there's probably quite a few but other things that I could have chosen, but I did eventually manage to pick the three that I thought were most significant. So yeah, no, it was been a bit of a journey for me personally as well.
And it's been quite a long time since I actually asked you, so yeah. how does it feel to now be in the room and about to start?
Actually quite relieved, because like everything in life, you know, when you start reflecting and thinking about things, it kind of takes you on a bit of a journey, and you kind of open filing cabinets in your head that you have been closed for quite some time. So I suppose I was getting to the bit now where I felt that I just wanted to almost get it out of the way, if you know what I mean, because a lot of these filing cabinets are still sitting open, and it enables me to kind of then able to talk about my objects, talk about my experience, and then I can shut my filing cabinets again. So
well, I think then on that note, it's probably a good time to start with your first object so we can shut that filing cabinet. So this object represents before care. Caroline, what's your first object?
Well, it's not a physical thing because I couldn't bring it with me, because I would have to rip it off of a lift and it would probably be quite heavy to carry. But the first object that represents me prior to me coming into care is actually a set of very old elevator doors that used to have the metal gates that people used to have to pull shut. Now, the reason that that probably represents the before, because that image and those gates were probably my first experience of being taken away from my family home, myself and my sister. And it's the first almost gateway to my care journey where I can remember being taken to a social work department with two strange old ladies, and the very first thing that I seen when I went into the social work department was those elevator gates.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is that I don't really have a lot of memories prior to that memory, which, you know, part of that is because I was very young. I mean, I think I was probably 3 when I was taken into care. My sister was 2. So obviously, you know, people probably don't have a lot of memories of their of being a baby and a toddler and stuff like that. But I do have a couple of memories, which is quite interesting, because one of them does associate with those elevator gates, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Prior to me going into care, I can remember I had this realisation that my mum wasn't around. My dad was in the house. I think he was sleeping or something, and all of a sudden I just had this realisation that my mum wasn't there, and I couldn't understand why. And I can remember getting a chair, stepping, this is actually how small I was, right? I can remember getting a chair, stepping up to the front door, unlocking the front door, getting off the chair and actually walking out the house. And the intention obviously was that I was trying to find my mum. The next thing I can remember is walking up a very big street and a white van pulling over at the side, and I subsequently realised that they were the police. So the police are probably going, yeah, okay, why is a 3-year-old girl in the middle of the night walking about by herself? And I remember them putting me into the back of the van. Now, this was the 70s, and if people know what cars looked like in the 70s, it was a really horrible, small, mini sort of transit van thing. And I can remember being put into the back of this van, and the thing that just sticks out in my head more than anything else was there was blood all over the van walls. So this was obviously the van that they chuck all the drunks and people, you know, who are getting arrested and stuff into. And I just remember feeling really, really, really scared. So I started crying. I remember being taken to the police station, and eventually they put me in a room, and eventually I think my dad came and got me. But that is one of the very few other sort of memories that I have prior to me getting into care. Another memory I have, which is quite interesting, is out playing with my auntie. Now, my auntie was really, really young. My auntie was probably only about, 9, 10 at the time, and actually falling on glass. So that must have been, it must have been blooming sore, that's why I remember it. You know, but that's one of the other very few memories that I have, is falling on glass, going home. I do remember getting cuddles off my mum, and funnily enough, when I was reflecting on this, I've actually still got the scars on my knees to prove that I did. So yeah, so that's quite interesting. I think the only other memory that I have, if in a kind of physical sense, is playing in the park. I lived near Kelvin Grove Park, lovely big park. And when I was younger, they had the fountain switched on. So they've got a big fountain, and it was switched on, and it was just full of kids, full of bodies. And I can actually remember playing in that fountain when I was a wee girl. So it's quite interesting that these are kind of quite sort of physical memories, but I don't actually have many memories of my mum and dad, which I find is really, really interesting. I don't have memories of them being together. I don't have memories of particularly doing stuff with them. You know, all the memories that I have, or the few that I have, are actually quite a kind of separate physical thing about me, but not really about me with my parents. So, yeah, I think that's probably most of the things kind of prior to me coming into care.
And so do you think then that this period of time has had an impact on you throughout your life? Because the memories that you do remember are quite specific moments that have probably caused you quite a lot of distress at that time.
Yeah, I think what's interesting for me is I suppose I'm always questioning why those specific memories are more kind of prevalent in my head. Why don't I remember the relationship that I had with my parents? Why don't I remember being kind of loved or cared for? I can only remember these little small clusters, but I can't actually remember anything in relation to a relationship that I had with my family. And I think it probably has an impact, and it has had an impact, because years many, many, many years later, I did meet my mum, but I clearly had no attachment with her. Mm-hmm. And I know that young people that I work with in care today, regardless of the trauma, regardless of the issues that they've had, they still have an attachment with their family, even if they haven't seen them for a significant period of time. Mm-hmm. There's still something there. I never had that. And, you know, I think more than anything, that's disappointing for me because mm-hmm. I don't understand why. But that's basically the effect that it's had, is that I don't have a relationship with my mum, which I did try to do, but I just never had the attachment.
Yeah. Do you think it's had an impact on you as a parent now? 'Cause you've...
If anything, it's had the complete and utter reverse impact, because it's actually made me more conscious and more aware of the importance of telling my kids every day or in nearly in every conversation that I love them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, because I've got a 16-year-old and an 11-year-old now, but sometimes for the 16-year-old, you know, it's like, oh, for God's sake, Mum, do you know what I mean? And it's pure embarrassment, but I don't care. As long as he knows that I'm always there for him and that he is loved, and he's loved every minute of every day, and as long as my daughter is aware of that as well, then for me, that's what good parenting is. You know, what happened to me as a child is not going to define who I am as a parent now. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because that's about me as an individual. It's not about what I experienced when I was younger. So, yeah, it's probably has had a bit of an impact. I'm probably a very soft touch as well, if I'm honest with you. I'm always trying to negotiate with my kids instead of, you know, right, that's it. Put my foot down. My husband's a complete opposite, because my husband's been brought up in a family environment and he gets it. I haven't, so I think that also maybe makes me treat my kids probably a wee bit different. Mm-hmm. More than anything else, I'm more conscious of what it's like to not have a family, so I would rather that, you know, my kids felt loved and, you know, they know that I'm there for them regardless. So.
Absolutely. So there's two different types of impact there. One's probably a little bit negative, depending on who views that, but the parenting's definitely a positive.
Absolutely.
So you spoke a bit about entering the care system, the very moment actually that you entered the care system as your first object. So I think now's a good time to move on and explore your second object, which represents during care. What is your object for during care?
Okay, so during care, I have some pictures. Okay, so I've actually got a picture. So this is a very 70s type picture, because it was the 70s. Not going to show my age, but you can probably guess. But so this is actually a picture of my sister at the age of 2. The significance about this picture is that it came from a photo album that was given to me by someone who looked after me when I was in this particular children's home at the time. So I became an advocate in Glasgow in 1999 when I joined Who Cares Scotland. And obviously as part of my advocacy role, you're meeting social workers, you're going to meetings on behalf of young people, you're visiting children's houses, and I just happened to get a phone call one day from this woman, and I think she worked in the sort of fostering service in Glasgow City Council, and she was like, oh, hi, she says, you wouldn't happen to be Caroline, previous second name? And I'm like, yeah, that's me. And she went, oh my goodness, she went, I looked after you when you were a little girl, my name's such and such. And as soon as she said her name, I knew exactly who she was. And she was probably one of my, how would you say, favourite members of staff and stuff like that. So that was just lovely that someone had heard of me and had reached out to me, which was absolutely amazing. So she then said that she had kept a lot of photos and photo albums of the young people that she had cared for in this particular care home. And she asked me if I wanted some photos. And I was like, oh, wow. And I was like, really? I says, you know, I don't have any photos of myself probably below the age of 12. And that would be absolutely amazing. So she had reached out to me, we'd met up, she took the time to kind of give me the photo album. And it's amazing how visual pictures can just open so many memories in your head, and it's memories that I've just been lying dormant for so many years because you don't have any physical reference to them. And going through the photo album, I could remember faces. I couldn't remember all the names, but I could remember faces, I could remember places, I could remember events. But the most important thing is that I had a small snapshot of my childhood that I hadn't had before. So that was something that was really, really special. Every picture that I was in, it was almost like it just brought a memory. Some good, some bad, I have to say, but it just brought memories of my time in that children's home. And it was pretty special. So the photo particularly that I brought of my sister, actually that's the youngest picture that I have of my sister as well, which is really quite important. So it was a very, very special gift to receive.
And did you stay in that children's home then for a long time?
Or? Yeah. So I was in that children's home probably from the age of about 5 till I was about maybe 11, 12. It was a very big home. It was a home in Glasgow, and there was a sort of cluster of lots of different homes round about the area that it was in, and there was about 40 kids in it, so it was a huge big children's home. They were all split up into the, I think they called them different houses and they called them names. So it was almost like you would be in a particular house with particular young people and you would have your own sort of members of staff, but you were in this huge big house, but it was kind of almost split up. You like the bedrooms, for example, I can remember the bedroom that I was in, there was about 5 other girls.
Wow.
So it was almost like you had a bed, a table, a bed, a table, and that's basically how it was kind of set. It was like a dorm. If I'm honest, it was like a kind of dormitory. The interesting thing was at that time, the staff that were looking after us, a lot of the staff were really, really young. I mean, some of them probably got their jobs at 16 and so they were very, very young. But a lot of the staff lived in.
Okay.
So I can remember where the bedroom that I was in was situated. You would have like the girls' bedroom, and then there was a room in the middle that had a door connecting. A member of staff slept in there, so she basically lived in there 24/7 basically. And then the other side to her, there was another connecting door, and it was the boys' bedroom. So it meant that obviously, you know, if you woke up during the night and you were anxious or scared or upset, whatever, you actually had somebody who could physically get up and tend to you and kind of take care of you. So that was actually pretty special. That was actually a really nice memory, and quite a special memory. That gave me a sense at least of consistency. So at least you were able to build relationships with people, even if they weren't, your parents.
6 years is quite a long time for a placement.
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, I spent most of my kind of primary school years in this children's home, and the thing that's so interesting is, you know, I lived with 40 people, but as a young person I felt quite alone a lot of the time, which is quite interesting. I actually, when I was reflecting on this, I was thinking, I actually made up an imaginary friend, and she was called Jane. And Jane basically did everything with me. A lot of the times I would walk to school myself and walk home myself, and Jane was there, and we would have races, and we would talk about, you know, shows that we'd seen on the telly, and, you know, we would talk about, yeah, we're going to go to the park, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and, you know, to some people that might sound silly, but to me, even now, she was actually my friend, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that is how lonely I felt at the time, do you know what I mean? And I felt as if I had to make this... She had red hair and everything, I can remember. I felt I had to make up this imaginary friend just to feel as if, you know, I was connected to somebody or somebody was there for me. I mean, even despite the fact that I was living even with my sister was still quite young and, you know, we're quite different in ages and stages and stuff. So, I did feel very, very alone. And there was also other things that, you know, were not great about that home, you know, that things like, you know, racism was quite a thing at that in the sort of mid to late 70s as well. You know, I had staff calling me Chicken George from a programme that was on in the 70s called Roots, and they thought that that was funny. They thought that was completely appropriate. And obviously, if the staff are calling me, the young people start calling you, and it just kind of singles you out and makes you feel quite...
So it probably contributed, actually, to that feeling.
Yeah.
Things like that.
It probably did, and it's quite sad that it was the staff that kind of started it, you know what I mean? But and then, obviously, as young people do, they're just going to jump on the bandwagon, and straight away, you're made to feel very different. You know, the 70s was a very difficult time anyway when you're a mixed race.
Do you know, it sounds like actually that would have been quite overpowering, and if you're in a home with 40 children who are all saying the exact same thing, like, that's... Yeah. Absolutely terrifying.
What was interesting at that time was there was me and my sister who was mixed race. There was one other sibling group who were in that home who were also mixed race, and that was it. You know, so we all just stood out like sore thumbs. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, and we all coped with it. And coped with that type of, you know, pressure in very different ways, do you know what I mean? I was probably a bit more quiet and subdued, but I can remember the other siblings, you know, there was one boy in particular, he would just barter everybody. But you can understand
absolutely
why he was so angry, was because obviously he's been made to feel like this and made to feel different, so yeah.
And probably already feeling different because you're in that setting in the first place, but then feeling even more segregated in a totally unusual environment. That must have been really hard to navigate, I think. So you were there until you were 11, did you say?
I think it was about 11, it was about primary six. So basically what happened, well, what I think accelerated my return home was that, well, two things. Dad remarried, and actually I found out that the children's home I was living in was due to close.
Okay.
So because my dad had remarried, they felt that it was all right for me and my sister to go home because we now had a family unit again, and that it would be okay. So I did go home then, and I think it lasted probably for about... just over a year. And there was a mixture of reasons for that. Obviously, my dad being from a different culture, my dad was very... still quite ingrained in his culture in terms of how you bring up kids and various other things, like you have to go to mass every Sunday and stuff. I had been brought up in a different culture.
Yeah.
I had spent a significant amount of my childhood in a different culture, not having to go to mass every Sunday, not even understanding what Catholicism was, all that type of stuff, but also the rules and regulations that we live by in terms of how we treat kids in this country are very different to how other countries and other cultures will treat their kids. And, you know, my dad was trying to get us to conform to his culture and his way of, you know, living and stuff like that. And we couldn't do it. We tried, but it was constantly battles with my dad, a lot of unhappiness as well. And I was getting to a stage where I was starting to take my unhappiness out of my sister, which was completely inappropriate, but I just didn't know what else to do. And eventually social work took the decision that this is not working, and we were subsequently brought back into care. We were brought into a children's house where as soon as I walked through the door, it was like, I don't know, being in the middle of a gangland warfare. It was the most scariest thing I've ever experienced in my life. My sister and me were the youngest children in this children's home. Most of the kids were about 14, 15, 16, 17. They also had a mother and baby unit, which was quite interesting as well. So we were brought into this children's home where, honestly, every night was like chaos. So you would have fire alarms being set off all the time, people running about smashing windows all the time, teenage girls constantly self-harming, or teenage girls getting boys jumping into their bedrooms. It was chaos. It was absolute chaos, and I don't think I've ever felt more scared.
It's just a high level of vulnerability to be putting a child into. All these other teenagers are clearly in right in the midst of their vulnerability, and that's not a good place to put more children.
Because you have to bear in mind that the children's home that we were in prior to that was very controlled.
Mm-hmm.
It was run, you know, in a very sort of strict way. We were brought up strict, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? I didn't even know what a swear word was. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know what buzz and glue meant. So there was we were quite innocent.
Yeah.
And then we were put into this place that was just, it was chaos every single day. Every single day I was basically living in fear, absolutely living in fear. And my sister was probably even worse. And at that time, you know, we were told by our social worker, oh, we'll get his move. We know this is not the right place for you. But it took them, I don't know, almost something like a year, just over a year to move us. So what's interesting is when I went into that children's home, I was quite quiet, quite reserved. I was a good girl.
Mm-hmm.
Did what I was told. No hassle to anyone. By the time I left it, I had buzzed gas, buzzed nail polish. I had self-harmed. I knew just about every single swear word in the dictionary, and it actually took away my innocence, if I'm being brutally honest with you, and that's quite sad. That is quite a sad thing for me to say, is that children's home opened my eyes to the reality and the horror sometimes of what your care experience can be, and that's quite sad. And, you know, for all the nice relationships I had with staff, I had no relationships with the young people because they were all caught up in their own horrible nightmares and chaos that, you know, you just couldn't.
No.
You really couldn't. Plus the fact, because they were so much older than us, there was just, you know, I mean, you know, you had 15-year-old boys trying to jump into, like, mine and my sister's room at night and stuff like that as well. The police, I think, lived in that children's home, do you know what I mean? You know, it really was the most horrific experience of what care is supposed to be that I'd ever encountered in my life. But what it did do is it did actually take away my innocence.
That's really sad.
Yeah, no, it is quite sad. And actually, when I look back now, that point in my life in terms of, like, me and my sister, it's actually probably affected my sister more than it's affected me, and she'll never, ever talk to me about it because she can't.
Of course.
Yeah, so that's how hard it was. So we went from that children's home, so we went from being the youngest in a children's home to a lovely 12-bedded children's home, and I was the oldest. Oh my goodness, was I in my element. Yeah, here comes Caroline. I actually really have nothing negative to say about that children's home. It was everything that we should have had in the previous one that we didn't, and if we'd have went to that place first, I think I would have still had been the lovely, naive, I don't know much about life type person who at that stage was entering into becoming a teenager. I made friends locally. I actually felt more confident to be able to kind of come out my shell a wee bit more. I didn't feel so lonely or so isolated. I felt safe, which is really good. That home is where I started first year. So I've got another wee picture to show you. So that's my first year picture.
Oh, wow, you look exactly the same.
Yeah, never change. I'm always going to look like this. I'm going to look beautiful forever, honestly. Do you like my afro?
It's cute.
Thank you. So, yeah, so that's another real positive memory for me because I was really happy there, really settled there.
You do look happy in the photo, you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I just, I, I, I'd found my wee niche of friends. I liked where I lived. I liked the staff. I got on really well with everyone. There was, you know, no major issues. You know, if anything, it was almost like I was becoming this person that was the, you know, the almost like the mentor, if you know what I mean, for the younger kids and stuff like that. You know, the staff would utilise me in a very positive way, you know, because I didn't dog school. I didn't, you know, did all the, you know, things that you're supposed to do and stuff like that. But at that time, unfortunately, there was then that whole debate and discussion about, oh, you know, I think it's about time you need to consider going home. You know, you've got a mum, you've got a dad, and, you know, and by that time I had some step siblings as well. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you make decisions in your life because you think that's what you should do, or you should have a view or opinion because you think that's what other people want you to have and all that stuff. And I think at that point, you know, it was almost like, right, okay, well, maybe they're right, maybe I don't need to be in care anymore. And, you know, even though I didn't want to leave where I was, I kind of agreed and said, right, okay, I'll move on. Stupidly, I kind of believed that my dad had made promises about, yeah, you can stay at the school that you're at and all that stuff. And I should have, in hindsight, thought, how am I going to get from the west end of Glasgow to south side of Glasgow to go to school? But when I was younger, I believed what he said. So I agreed, okay, it's time to go home. So I went home and straight away I had to change schools, and I was horrified because he was putting me in a Catholic girls' school.
That's a massive culture shock.
Oh, my goodness. I was like, what? Yeah, no, you have to go to this school, and this is the best school, and this, that, and the next thing. And that just started, I think, another sort of unfortunate process of a downward spiral between me and my relationship with my dad and living at home and all that stuff. And again, I tried as much as I could, but by that time I was a teenager. I was going out with my pals, and you're not going to tell me that I'm not going out with my pals and stuff like that. I just was trying to be a teenager and to hang about my pals. And but again, the cultural elements of you know, my dad's parenting and stuff like that were just not the same as what they are in this country. And I was just constantly fighting with him. Constantly fighting with him. And it's really sad because not only did that then, you know, damage the relationship between me and my dad, it damaged the relationship between me and my siblings. Because they're obviously been brought up with my dad and the culture and everything else, and they're not understanding why, you know, that idiot in there is going pure mental with my dad because she's not allowed to go out and all that stuff, you know. And sometimes I would actually just walk out. There was also times when my dad would chuck me out as well. I've spent many a comfortable night in a close in Glasgow, which has been quite interesting. So, yeah. Unfortunately, things just kind of continued to deteriorate to the point, unfortunately, where I'd had one altercation with my dad, which resulted in my dad hitting me. And that was it. So I ended up going into school, telling my guidance teacher, and that was it. They phoned social work, and they ended up, funnily enough, this is so funny, they ended up putting me in a hostel. It was a girls' hostel, which was kind of teenage to slightly older girls, but it was exactly 1, 2, 3, 4 streets away from my dad's house.
That sounds like a good decision.
So that was great. That was absolutely brilliant. And actually, you know, and my dad used to walk past the house and shouting obscenities about me and stuff like that because he knew that's where I was put and stuff like that, which is a wee bit sad, but that's what happened. That's the reality. So yeah, so I was put in the hostel, and again, it's, you know, you kind of succumb to peer pressure a wee bit when you're living in group living. And I did start doing really stupid things again, and again, I can reflect, and in my head I'm thinking, I knew that was blooming stupid. I knew half the stuff I was doing. I was like, what am I doing? But I done it, because part of sometimes living in groups is you feel as if you've got to fit in. It's because, see, if you don't fit in, they will make your life hell.
Yeah. You've already felt that feeling of aloneness as well when you were growing up, yeah. So you don't want to repeat that.
That's it, absolutely. So to me, it is like you had to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
And to be fair, I wasn't stupid. I would play it to a certain extent, but I wouldn't ever, you know, step over lines where I end up getting arrested by police. I might get cautioned by police, like, right, yous move away from there or something like that, or, you know, right, where's your cans and stuff, you know, but I never really took it to any sort of, you know, extreme of, like, committing crime or anything like that. So, so I continued to go to my girls' school whilst I was in there, but actually I ended up making some really, really good friends. I was quite surprised because I thought girls' school, no boys, I'm going to hate this and I'm going to leave as soon as I can. But I actually made some really, really good friends. I've actually got another picture with me. Now, this is me hanging about or dogging it in Botanic Gardens with my friend who I will not mention. Displaying, doing something very inappropriate, but it's all right. That was a time.
You look tiny here.
I know. That's because she looks tall, but she isn't. She's smaller than me. I think it's because I was leaning back.
That's such a funny photo, actually.
So that was me. I think that was either second or third year. Now, the reason that that picture is significant to me is because I don't have, and I'm not somebody who has ever consistently, how would you say, kept friends. And I sometimes think that's also a consequence of my childhood and the fact that I don't allow myself to trust people. And sometimes I end up almost like gravitating away from people before they gravitate away from me, if you know what I mean. But this person has been the only person that hasn't done that. And she is still she's still my best friend.
It's so nice to hear that.
It doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter whether we don't speak. We can go months without speaking, but I know as soon as I pick up the phone, she's there, and there's something so comforting and so special about that, because if I'm honest, she's probably one out of two friends that I would probably say that is, you know, that's the relationship I have. But she's the most, the one that's been there the longest. She's the one that when I had went back into care, her parents had wanted me to go to their house for Christmas dinner. Which was, that was lovely. It was just, I was so humbled that they wanted me to spend Christmas with them.
There's no other feeling to describe that as well, is there? There's nothing that can top that.
And even the fact that the parents had to go through full police checks, they still wanted me to, you know, come and stay, you know, even though they couldn't understand why, you know, they had to do police checks and stuff. But they went through all that and they still accepted me into their house and I spent Christmas with them. So there is something very, very special about that.
It sounds like your care journey, being in care, there's been so many very high moments and very positive moments, and it's been a bit of a roller coaster, actually. Even just the placements that you've been in, there's been so many different types of things, but there's some things that you've spoken about really highly of that you've taken away from it, which is, as a listener, is really nice to see and hear. So thank you for sharing that. Like, it's actually lovely to hear that. I think before I even ask this question, you can hear the impact that this period of time's had on you.
Yeah.
But I'm going to ask it anyway. Yeah. This is quite a massive period of your life. So what impact do you think that's had on you?
It's quite kind of different impacts in different areas of my life. In terms of my personal relationships, it has impacted probably quite negatively in the sense that, you know, I've probably had times in my life where people have wanted to be alongside me, where people have said, you know, oh, I like you as a person, I want, you know, to get to know you as a friend. But the kind of demons about whether people are actually out to get something from me, or, you know, do I actually trust them, or are they going to let me down? They're always there. And I've probably had some friendships where I'm the person who has pulled back from a friendship because I didn't, you know, because I didn't want to get hurt. And I've probably been the one that's actually done the damage, if you know what I mean, because people have wanted to, you know, be part of my life and stuff, and I've deliberately not let them. So that's quite disappointing. Also, relationships with men as well. I very quickly entered into a relationship with someone at the age of 15, and always at the back of my mind, I was never 100% sure as to why I was with this person, but actually I needed to feel as if I was special. And if somebody makes me feel special, particularly, you know, if it's somebody who's, you know, you're romantically linked with, you know, that was me. I was just like, right, okay, so I'll settle for this because this guy says that I'm special and he loves me. And the consequence of that for me was I spent 12 years with somebody that I really shouldn't have been with. I didn't love him because I think at that point I still didn't understand what love was. And again, you know, I have to be honest about the fact that I could have finished it, I could have left him, but I ended up getting engaged to him, I ended up getting married to him, and every step of the way it was almost this thing about how do I get out of this, do you know what I mean? But I just kept going, and you know, and eventually I found the strength to do it. But you know, I should have been more honest with him as well, but at the time I just needed to have someone who loved me. And that's not a relationship. So even in terms of your personal relationships, what you experience when you're younger can make a significant impact on the choices that you make when you're older.
It's a massive impact then. So we're coming to our final object, which represents aftercare. You kind of briefly touched on it in a couple of times there, but aftercare being where you are now and the journey up to this point, Caroline, what is your last object?
Okay, my last object, hear him rattling. It is a traditional teddy bear. He's just called Ted.
Ted.
I never named him, and I don't know why, but he spent many a year sitting on my bed. The reason why he's so special to me is because if I was to think about things that I keep from my care journey, apart from some of the pictures that I was speaking about earlier on, in terms of physical things, this is the only thing that I have. And this was given to me by my foster parents, who I ended up going to live with at the age of 15. After I left the hostel, the girls' hostel, I went to live with a family in Glasgow. Now, they were a loving, nurturing family. They were very religious. They very Christian, you know, and they didn't have a telly in the house. And I'm just like, no way. Social worker, get me a television set and stuff like that. So I was a bit like, right, okay, so I'll give it a try, but nah, this is not going to work type thing. And they were all, you know, they were just really, really, really nice people. They didn't have a bad bone in their body. So I went to live with them. And at first, you know, they kind of started to kind of let me do what I wanted. So I was going out with my pals all the time. I was going out to see my pal that I've mentioned earlier and all that stuff. But after a wee while, my foster dad would start having conversations with me about what I wanted to do with my life, what I wanted to achieve. And basically he was saying, look, if you just keep going out all the time, you're not going to achieve anything. If you really want to do something with your life, I can help you, and this is how I can help you. So they started helping me with my education. That was the first thing, because I was a wee bit lost. I didn't really know what I was wanting to do when I left school and stuff like that, and actually to some extent I actually didn't really care at that point, but he made me care, if you know what I mean, because he made me start to think about myself a wee bit more in a more sort of positive way. He very subtly but very very succinctly kind of helped me to build my confidence and helped me to believe in myself. And it was even things like he would create a study plan for me. What? Study plan? And I'm studying in my life. You're having a laugh. And he actually really said, look, you know, you have a choice with anything that you do in your life. If you want to do well, the choice is yours. We will help you as much as you can, but you're the person that's going to have to put the graft in and put the work in. So I thought, right, no, I think maybe he's got a point. Maybe he's got a point. So he helped me with all that. And for the first time, I think, ever in my life, I actually started to feel as if I could actually achieve and actually do something and actually maybe I can pass my exams and stuff like that. So I remember fourth year, that's when that whole process started. And when I got my exam results in fourth year, I could not believe it. You could have knocked me down my feather because I actually passed most of them.
Really? Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. And as a present and as a wee, you know, well done, I was given TED as a wee present for that. But that was only, I suppose for me, that was only kind of start of the journey, because then I had to go through fifth year. And fifth year was very, very challenging. But again, my foster parents were supportive. They were consistent. They were very patient, even when I had my periods where I kind of kicked against the, you know, no, I'm, you know, because what I very quickly found was I was actually starting to love them. And I thought that whole bit about, right, no, I'm going to be rejected. So I started doing the whole kind of rebellion stuff again, but they were still there. It didn't matter what I did, they were still there, they were still consistent. And after a wee while, I thought, right, okay, so they're not going to reject me, so I'm just going to knuckle down and get on with it. So I did. And in fifth year, I also got hires as well. And I have to be absolutely upfront and honest and say that if I didn't have their love and their support at that time in my life when I really needed it, I wouldn't have passed my exams. So they're very, very special people. They're still very special people to me. And TED just always represents something for me in terms of the first time I felt as if I'd achieved something, you know, and actually he's the recognition of that. So even though I loved staying in my foster parents, by the time I've hit fifth year, I was starting to get really itchy feet, and I made a really stupid decision, and I decided I was going to speak to my social worker because I wanted to get my own flat. So by that time, that was me 17, and my foster parents tried their best to talk me out of it, and in hindsight, I wish they had, but they didn't. And yeah, and I know I've told this story before, but I genuinely was looking, going to see flats with my school uniform on, which is just ridiculous now. Like, you know, if I'm working with young people just now, I'd be like that. Are you sure you want to do this? Do you understand what you're letting yourself in for? But at that stage, and it's not that it wasn't anything to do with my foster parents or the relationship. I was just exercising my rights to do what I thought I wanted at that time. So I ended up basically leaving care and moving out of my foster parents' house at the age of 17.
And did you move into another hostel, or did you end up in a flat straight away?
Straight into a lovely wee flat. And what was then and very interesting, the very first thing that I did was I moved a friend who was a friend at that point right in with me. So she ended up having my living room, and I ended up having my bedroom. Again, reflecting on that, I didn't want to be alone. And as much as I was saying, oh my goodness, I'm so ready to move into my flat and everything, I wasn't. And that is how I know that I wasn't, was because as soon as the opportunity presented itself, I've got somebody else living with me, because I didn't want to, do you know what I mean, live by myself. So that was an interesting 6 months, because it only lasted 6 months, and then I physically had to kick her out because she was having parties, and I almost lost my tenancy because of her, and just really, really silly stuff. But then when she left, my ex-partner moved in. So it's just, I've, again, that is a consequence. of what I experienced as a child and that utter feeling of loneliness is that I felt I couldn't live on my own. I couldn't be lonely. Even something as simple as sleeping with the radio on every night. I did that every night because I couldn't get to sleep. And I've said this before to people, but when you're lying in a dark room at night and you're actually listening to silence, I found it horrible. I always just needed to have noise. I needed to have something. I couldn't. It was like the silence hurt my ears, you know? So, yeah, so that was the kind of journey for me moving out of care and my first experience in terms of getting my own flat and all that. And it wasn't the ideal. Again, it wasn't the greatest start for me because I wasn't making the right choices because of my own kind of feelings and anxiousness and stuff, so...
That sounds like it was, again, a bit of a roller coaster ride for you.
Yeah.
Did you stay in that flat for quite a long time? Or?
Yeah. Part of that for me was experiencing a childhood where, apart from the second home I was in for 5 years, where I never felt I stayed anywhere for a particularly long time, you know, I can remember, you know, people will historically talk about, you know, kids moving from placement to placement and black bags. I had the black bags. And I, you know, even, you know, because I've talked about the sort of main experiences of living in some of the children's homes, but that wasn't all the children's homes I was in. I was in some other foster placements, you know, and that thing of almost not... of being afraid to unpack something in case you're going to get moved again. I totally get that. I totally understand that because there was periods in my life that I could remember feeling like that. So when I got this flat, to feel as if for the first time that as long as I pay my rent, this is mine and nobody can take it away from me was quite overpowering. So I actually ended up buying my flat when I had the first opportunity to do it because I just needed to know that this was mine and nobody was going to take it off me, and that's exactly what I did. So I ended up being in that flat probably for about 12 years.
That's a long time.
Aye, absolutely. It was a great wee flat. I loved it.
Yeah. Sounds like you did have some happy memories then. If you loved it, there must have been some.
Yeah. No, I mean, I suppose, you know, I have spoken about my ex-partner because obviously he was there for a kind of huge part of it, but I, you know, I have other positive memories, you know, of of friends, you know, going out with friends, and you know, I think one of the successes in my life has probably been the jobs that I've had. I don't understand why. I was trying to reflect on that to see if I could maybe, you know, give you some sort of explanation to that, but actually the jobs that I've had in my life has been the most successful part of my life. The first job that I got was when I was still at school, was working in a supermarket, but that was my first taste of earning money, being independent, being able to spend money on what I wanted, and I have never ever been unemployed since age 15. I have always worked and had some sort of job. Thank you very much. But even I put myself through college when I was working. The first sort of full-time job that I had was working in a bank. And I spent 5 years working in that bank. And then I moved to, it was like a local community centre type thing, doing admin. And I was there for 2 years. And then, what I should explain, I suppose, in terms of my care journey as to where I am just now with my employment, is when I first moved into my flat, my whole, previous life ended. I never talked about it. I never said anything to anyone. I never told anyone I was in care. I was embarrassed to even tell people. So as far as they were concerned, you know, I could almost said that my foster parents had adopted me. That's how much I didn't want people to know that I was in care. The jobs that I had reflected that. So working in a bank, working in a supermarket, I didn't have to, I could make up who I was to anybody because they wouldn't know me. So they wouldn't know what I did. After I had worked in the community centre, I had seen this job and it was just an admin post. I'm saying just an admin post. Admin is very important, very skilled. And it was working for a private fostering service. And at first, I was only looking at it from the basis of, right, I'm really good at admin and this, that and the next thing. But see, when I got into this service, it was a service that was just being set up, I very quickly just got this sense of almost awareness and understanding of what they were doing, because I had experienced it myself. And I hadn't really said to anyone that I had been care experienced before, but very quickly it was almost like my experience was just really coming to the surface with me, if you know what I mean. And I ended up having a conversation with my manager at that time, who at first had no idea that I had been in care. And as soon as she found out that I had been in care, you know, she was saying things like, well, do you know what, it would be really helpful, see if young people come in, could you maybe spend a wee bit of time with them, because obviously you can empathise with them. And she actually positively then utilised my care experience, and that's the first time I'd ever done that. And I found there was a real power behind doing that. But not only so that I could then maybe help and support young people who maybe didn't have MD to talk to and struggling a wee bit, but there was a real power for myself. It empowered me as well, because all of a sudden I wasn't ashamed anymore to actually tell people or to, you know, actually recognise the fact that that was my experience, whether I liked it or not. And then probably I was with them for about 3 or 4 years and I absolutely loved it. But then that's when Who Care Scotland came calling. And the rest is history, because if you think about, you know, people will go through different jobs in life and will do different employments, and some of them might find fulfilment in certain things, some of them might not, and you're always kind of searching for that thing that just kind of fulfills you, you know, to your core, if you know what I mean. And that is what Who Cares Scotland does for me, because to have a job and to do a job that's connected to your life in every sense of the word, I think very few people get the opportunity to do that. And you'll probably understand what I'm saying is when you are able to find a place that, you know, that does that for you, why would I want to leave?
No, I totally get
20
that.
Years. You know what I mean? I will be pushing up the daisies by the time I leave this organisation, because I'm always, every day, I'm always waking up and thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to do a job that I love. And I know people can say that and be quite blasé about it, but I genuinely mean it. And, you know, because not only is it me helping other people, but it's putting a lot of my demons to bed, and it does it every day in different ways, but it just, it kind of settles me, it steadies me, and it just makes me stronger as well for being able to have the pleasure and privilege of being able to support care experienced people that are obviously going through their own care journeys today. So
something quite touching as well that you've brought this wee teddy bear from. Congratulations for your exam, and that's almost like being the kick up the arse that you needed to go on and figure all that out and then be here where you are now, and you're clearly so happy with
absolutely
that. But that journey was absolutely your determination and your drive, like just that wee bit of encouragement from Ted there, push this, and you've gone on a really remarkable journey actually to get here. It's
been quite bumpy, but would I have done anything different? I don't know, I'm not sure. Because your childhood doesn't define you as a person, and your life experiences will always change and evolve you as a person. And I think, you know, I've probably had to experience some of the things that I've had to be the person that I am today, do you know what I mean? But things will continue to evolve. My kids will continue to kind of challenge me and change me, but also this job will continue to do that as well. So there's also something special about that as well.
Absolutely. So I think that's us at the end of our objects. reflecting back now through these three objects that have obviously all had a massive impact on you, is there anything that you wish you had at any of these stages growing up or leaving care?
There's probably, and you know, some people will go, I'm saying this because I work for Who Cares, and this is not at all because I work for Who Cares, but there are points in time in my life where I truly have felt as if I've not had a voice, or I've not been able to understand decisions that have been made about me, or, you know, that feeling of helplessness and almost just being out of control, it's a horrible feeling to have. And I know that everyone will have certain situations and scenarios in your life that, you know, you'll have moments where you do feel like that, and mm-hmm. I totally understand that. But knowing what I know now and doing the job that I do, I'm absolutely convinced that periods where I had maybe been at my most crisis, or periods where, you know, I had been at my lowest, I think if I'd had someone alongside me to just actually, you know, speak for me, mm-hmm. and not because they've got an agenda or they're doing their job or anything, but not to actually listen and say, right, what is it? You know, I eventually got that with my foster parents, mm-hmm. but there was probably moments when I needed it earlier, mm. And I didn't have that, and that's quite disappointing. The other thing for me is I wish I had went to live with my foster parents earlier.
Mm.
That's because I think if I had, I don't think I would have moved out as quickly as I did. And there was a lot of kind of stuff that I went through, particularly in my early teens, that again, if I'd had that sort of loving, nurturing relationship with my foster parents, I wouldn't have went through. Mm-hmm. You know, and to this day, you know, the fact that, you know, I can still have them in my life is really special, and that the you know, part of my kids' life as well. But I would have loved to have had them in my life earlier.
Mm.
I think that would have made a huge difference as well.
Yeah. So now you've been on objects, you've explored your care journey from start to finish through your three chosen objects. Our final question today is, what would you say to other care experienced people who are thinking about or are interested in being a guest of objects?
I think one of the things that I would say is that, you know, everything in life can present challenges sometimes, and sometimes it's very difficult to open certain filing cabinets in terms of exploring your journey and your life and stuff like that. But for me, actually, the experience of being able to open those cabinets has actually, it's actually been more of an enjoyment for me than anything else, because I can't go back and change
mm-hmm.
what happened to me. Okay, the past is the past, and that will forever where it will be. But it actually gives me a wee bit of strength and confidence to think that despite going through what I went through when I was younger, I'm sitting here married with two kids, mm-hmm. Fairly head screwed on. I do have my moments, I have to say. But the most important thing is that I'm happy and I'm confident and I have a sense of me.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter whether I open those filing cabinets or not, you know, I'm still sitting here and it will not change me as a person. It won't change who I am. And if anything, it actually gives me a bit of a inner strength
mm-hmm.
to say that I have achieved what I've achieved in spite of
mm-hmm.
what happened in my childhood. Mm-hmm. So I find it quite to me it's almost been a kind of wee bit of cleansing, you know, because I've had moments in the past where I've given people small snapshots of my care journey, but I've never actually been able to have a conversation where I've actually joined the dots.
Mm-hmm.
it's the first time I've actually joined the dots from start to finish, and it is actually quite refreshing to be able to do that. So for anyone who is wanting to do it, absolutely, you know, think about it, but remember, you're still in control of it.
Mm-hmm.
You're still in control of it.
I think that's a fabulous way to end a really enlightening, positive episode of Objects. Caroline, thank you for sharing your objects.
You're very welcome.